radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hi, and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. And this month we're going to divert a little bit from our normal podcast rundowns where we cover a whole host of subjects. And we're really going to concentrate on safety-related items this month. It's kind of appropriate. Those of listeners that have picked up recent copies of Firehouse Magazine and some of the other trade publications out there, they'll note that in the June issues, most of the articles are related to looking at the 16 firefighter life safety initiatives that were put out by the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation a number of years ago. And under the guidance of Chief Ron Sarnicki, we're looking at revisiting some of those and how they can specifically apply to help us with our daily operations, and more specifically, keeping it in our realm here of where Mike and Tom have a little bit of knowledge, and some people might even question that, or at least they might question my engine knowledge. I don't think anybody would end up and question Brother Mike's knowledge on aerial devices, but we're gonna focus in on this morning on specific of those life safety initiatives and have a little discussion on those, and then launch into some of the NFPA standards and some things to do practically to assist us. So, Brother Mike, anything that you had here before we launch into this with respect to safety and some of the things that you've seen recently?
Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Brother Tom. There has just been a tremendous uptick of aerial-related incidents and accidents. I know on our rundown today we're going to discuss some NIOSH reports. A report just came out about a tragic incident that happened almost a year ago where a firefighter was operating a snorkel device and was crushed by his own device and was killed. And more recently, within the past week or so, we've had an aerial device, a ladder, end up in the wires and basically melted the truck to the street. And we've had another aerial device that was in close proximity to a sidewalk and a street on where the operator decided that they were going to put the outrigger on some grass after 6 inches of rain and operate off that side. And the jack obviously went through the earth, and the bucket ended up resting into the fire building. Just a lot of incidents. All of a sudden, there have been 7 line-of-duty deaths as it relates to aerial apparatus in the last 18 months. Any comments from you, Brother Tom?
Well, Mike, that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at to bring our listeners back home. And those of you that subscribe to the Firehouse Magazine, you crack that June issue open and you open up to page 79, and there are the 16 firefighter life safety initiatives that were first developed by the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation as a result of a summit held in March of 2004. So I guess to put things in the old timeline perspective, we're looking at we've got 5 years plus, 5 years and a couple of months since these initiatives were out there. And while you could probably argue in your department or maybe in your particular location, you've made some headway. We've got to look at the results in terms of the tragic line of duty deaths, or as Mike just related, in one case it resulted in a line of duty death, in the other case it was a pretty close call, as close as you might want to get. We're going to be looking at 3 of these initiatives. So starting out with initiative number 1, define and advocate the need for a cultural change within the fire service relating to safety, incorporating leadership, management, supervision, accountability, and personal responsibility. And that's probably more than a mouthful. And depending upon where you are in your departments, organization with respect to being a line firefighter or medic or being a company-grade officer or potentially a battalion chief or district chief that's overseeing several stations of operations, the training officer going right up the proverbial food chain, right to chief of department. The cultural change, to Mike's and my thoughts, needs to start within. And that cultural change goes right to me, Mike, to the last two words in that of talking about personal responsibility. If you go through your daily life thinking that your well-being in terms of the health and welfare of you and your family, and whether it's we're actually talking about our physical human health, the health of us from a spiritual standpoint, our economic health and your financial viability that's going to allow you to do what you want as you go through life, to me, that cultural change and personal responsibility go hand in hand. If, as you carry out your daily activities within your department, if you think that somebody else should always be doing what you're doing and to allow you to do less, if you are more concerned about your paycheck and less concerned about your physical appearance or the appearance of your company when you're out on the street performing training evolutions or possibly doing building inspections, then I guess it's time for that cultural change for you to sit down. As we would say, maybe it's time to sit down on a couch with Dr. Phil and have a heart-to-heart talk. Each of us individually are responsible for our personal well-being and safety. And while it's great that we've got organizations that we belong to, and some of them are very strong and very viable with great rules and regulations that are understood, where folks are accountable when they don't follow those, I would suspect, Mike, for every organization you can point out or one that maybe you've visited, you know, in the last 6 or 8 months, to see one that, as we would say, from Mike and Tom, you guys are on your A game. We've come and encountered with a department that is still just operating like it's 1962 and, frankly, really don't care one way or the other. So to me, Mike, that initiative number one, before we launch into numbers 8 and 16, which more specifically apply to apparatus and equipment where we try to make some impact with folks, if you don't have that level of personal responsibility and understand that our culture within the fire service needs to change, then the fact that we're 5 years and a couple months into the excellent efforts that the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation has made to try to attempt to change that culture. If you just want to sit on the bench and pretend you're playing a game of football with a leather helmet with no pads and no face guard, I guess it's time maybe for you to seriously consider what your vocation and what you've been attracted to, and when we need to get you to change up. Mike, any thoughts there?
Yeah, Tom, I think you hit the nail right on the head. And one of the things that we just simply don't take seriously for a variety of reasons, one, we are all A-type personalities that do this work as firefighters. B, we are risk takers. And C, we are adrenaline junkies. And those three psychological factors are those that attract the kind of people that we have to the fire service. And believe me, they are some of the best people on the face of the earth. But with that said, as it relates to personal safety, and as we both harp on all the time, only you can be in charge of your personal safety. Nobody should have to tell you to put a seatbelt on. Nobody should have to tell you slow down or stop it at intersections or red lights. Nobody should have to tell you that it would be in your best interest to maybe visit a doctor and check up on your own personal health. But the end result, if you don't do that, is based in the fact that officers from your FD are going to have to knock on the door of your family and tell them that, oh, he's not coming home or she's not going to come home, that you are now a statistic and you now have become a line of duty death. And interesting for the firefighter is that they're dead and it doesn't matter to them anymore. But in the wake of that death, there's a great degree of psychological mess that needs to be cleaned up. potentially a financial mess that needs to be cleaned up, and you are going to leave an awful lot of sad, unhappy people in your wake, and in most cases for a death that was absolutely and positively preventable, had the right safety issues been addressed, had you put a seatbelt on, had you slowed down, had you operated in a safe and concise manner, had those rules been found, those rules had been followed, certainly we wouldn't find ourselves in the place we are today, with on par to have over 100 line-of-duty firefighter deaths once again.
Oh, Mike, and that brings us to, you know, we talked about personal accountability and a cultural change in getting us to awaken. And like a lot of us, I think, maybe just run through our even normal daily lives, just like, well, you can read about a tragedy or some other event that happened. It could be geographically at the other end of the country or maybe even out of the country. And the first thought is, well, that doesn't really affect me because it wasn't me. It was somebody else, you know. And it's like it's not important till you bring it back home. And if you're unfortunate enough to have an incident in your own department or know someone that was injured and could be a close personal friend, and it could be at the other end of the country. Well, now it's not only important, it's really damn important because now it's hit home. So the second initiative we want to key in, number 8, utilize available technology wherever it can produce higher levels of health and safety. And while some of the our younger listeners may consider technology to be something that's computer-controlled or computer-generated or some electronic device, in this case, let's just look at a technology that's been out there for quite some period of time, and that's been seatbelts. As we'll talk about in a little bit with the NIOSH report, it's become very evident that we could have saved a goodly number of brother and sister firefighters from being a line of duty statistic had we just worn our seatbelt. Now, that's not a high degree on the technology scale of 1 to 10. That's not a high-tech item. But that, together with wearing your protective ensemble and clothing at all incidents. In the June issue of Firehouse Again, there's an excellent article written by Mike's and my good close friend Jay Gordon Routley entitled Time to Adjust Our Thinking, and talking about looking beyond surviving the immediate hazards at the scene of the incident with respect to respiratory protection. So that technology can come into play in a lot of different areas, yet it seems, at least to Mike and I, that sometimes this lowest level of technology, like seatbelts, something that's been out there and available for a long, long period of time, we just not only tend not to embrace it, we almost want to ignore it. I want to relate to an incident that I just happened to stumble across, Mike. This past week, I was out in the Monroe County area of New York on business during the middle of this week, and had stopped at a station during the daytime, and just as I normally do, introduce myself, say, "Hey, I'd like to look at your fire trucks." Well, Mike, this would have put a smile on your face. The gentleman that I had to ask was not in the fire station. This was in a all-volunteer organization. This gentleman was out in the parking lot, and I recognized right away because of my association with you. He was setting up cones in the parking lot to do an EVOC class. So I went over to the gentleman, introduced myself, and said, "Geez, looks like you're going to be doing some driving later today." And he filled me in as to what was going. It was going to be night number 1 of their New York State EVOC class. The gentleman was on the job as a career firefighter in the city of Rochester and was a New York State fire instructor. And momentarily I thought, wow, it had been a number of years since I had visited this one particular department that had four stations or four companies. And said, you know, here's somebody they're making an investment in their folks. They're doing some driver training. So I took a few pictures of their rigs, and he made arrangements to meet some other fellas that were up at another station. And I was going to take pictures of their rigs. And Shortly after I got there, the other two companies were toned out for a report of an automobile accident that was right adjacent to one of their fire stations. So the chief of department had come over to introduce himself and meet me, which was quite nice and unexpected, but very pleasurable. And the chief said, well, Tom, I'll meet you over at the other station. And I followed these gentlemen from Company 2 over to Company 3, and they got me in the back way. And lo and behold, Mike, I get there, and, yeah, it was an automobile accident, all right. It was a, I believe it was a Chevy or a Chrysler van that was on its side and was planted between a telephone pole and a flagpole. There probably was 7.5 room feet of space, and the van on its side was 7 feet. I don't think if you lined up a transit, you could have figured out how to do that. And there was entrapment, and there's two transformers literally just hanging by the wires that they were attached to. They waited for the local power company, RG&E, to show up to cut power so they could safely operate to extricate the person from the car. And literally, this was adjacent to the front ramp of the station. You talk about having no reaction time. And I commented to the chief and the incident commander after it was all over that I was more than impressed in that the everyone on the scene had full protective gear. People stayed within their assigned area. There were the engine guys that had stretched a protection line. The guys that operating the rescue had equipment staged, and as soon as the power was cut off, they went to taking the roof off, laying the roof down to extricate the patient out of the vehicle. The apparatus placement was just superb based on what they had to deal with and doing crowd control and everything. And in the middle of the day, conservatively, I didn't do an exact head count, but there had to be a 20 to 25 people plus that responded on two engines in the rescue to extricate this woman out of the car that I then later found out the car got there when she leaned over to pick up her dog because the dog was running around the car. And when she got back up, realized she was about to run into a truck that had parked off the side of the road, jerked the car hard to the left and apparently put it on its side and slid in there like you'd slide in a home plate. And in that particular department, you could just witness, based on everybody staying within a safe zone, everybody being geared up, no yelling and screaming, people going about their duty. You could tell these people had it together. And whether it was personal accountability, it was certainly training by utilizing the available rescue technology we have. I left that department after, you know, standing there for the better part of an hour as the event unfolded and became two things, Mike. Number one, impressed, but I guess a little bit more so just, and I'm sure that scenario was probably played out maybe hundreds of times throughout our country that day, but there was somebody that, a department that trained well, that had it together, that looked at firefighter safety as pretty darn important and not just something that you gave lip service to. So,
yeah, I Tom, have a similar story, and I saw something a couple months ago that within my own department that I didn't think that I would necessarily see in my time. Early on in my career in the FDNY, outsiders would certainly look at us with our blue denim coats and the lack of protective gear as being somewhat dangerous at times in the 70s and 80s, and that's not to paint everybody in the department certainly with that wide brush, but our injury rate would certainly have proven that out. But the other day, we went to a car fire, and it just so happens that Ladder 58 was out of service with Engine 45. 27 truck went with Engine 45 to a car fire, and everybody on Engine 45 got out in full PPE, including their SCBA, and were on air extinguishing a car fire as it should be. And I'll tell you, that just brought a warm feeling to my heart. And understanding that although the statistics, line of duty death statistics, may not necessarily prove it out, we have come an awful long way. What happens as far as we're no different with fire service news than any other news organization, at times we tend to kind of hedge towards the negative because that's the glitz and glamour and gore of what we do. and we don't necessarily highlight the positive as much as we should of stories like yours and mine, Tom, where firefighters are out there day in and day out. They're following all the rules. They're doing all the right things. They're doing some very dangerous things, some very heroic things, and taking great personal risk, but yet they come back to the station and one piece based on just simply that cultural change that we would all like to see and having a culture of safety.
Yeah, and that's good to hear, Mike, because like I said, we tend to get sometimes just overwhelmed by the negatives that are out there, and whether it's the, I don't know, sometimes it's, to me it's almost the Jerry Springer mentality that we'd rather highlight the bad stuff going on than looking at anything positive. So, you know, when you see incidents like that, that's not to diminish the fact that, yeah, it could be going on in a lot of other locations, but when you see it, I guess the old, you know, up close and personal, it's really nice to have that. And a third and final, and not to diminish any one of the other remaining, 13 that we didn't talk about, the life safety initiatives. But number 16, as they say, you know, last on the list, but first in our hearts, make safety a primary consideration in the design of apparatus and equipment. And that's where we're going to, you know, then launch off into a little bit more of our discussions on how, no matter what size department you have and how you operate small rural department with maybe just an engine and a couple of tankers and a water supply unit, you can be in a metropolitan department with 20 stations plus. These NFPA standards are vitally important, all right? And the ones we're going to talk about today is standard 1911, 1911, with which the official title is Inspection, Maintenance, Testing, and Retirement of In-Service Automotive Fire Apparatus. Standard 1912, which is Fire Apparatus Refurbishing. If your department is interested in rebuilding the unit, you certainly want to make sure you get your copy on that document. And then two things that we use at every significant fire and incident of any type, and it doesn't make, again, any difference whether we're talking about rural America and you've got limited resources with limited assets and equipment versus a department that has 15 engines and 10 ladder companies. These two things are the bread and butter of what we use every day. The standard 1932, the use, maintenance, and service testing of ground ladders, and the 1962 standard, inspection, care, and use of fire hose, couplings, nozzles, and the service testing of fire hose. So we're going to cover some things between Mike and I and get some commentary back on those. So above and beyond the 1901 standard, which we've all come to know and love, all right, and we would hope that most, if not all, of our listeners would have that standard at the ready and available in the fire station to refer to. These other four 1900 series standards that impact the fire service, 1911, 1912, 1932, and 1962, we would certainly think that departments should have those available as well. So to start out with, in 1911, all right, the standard for the inspection, maintenance, testing, and retirement of apparatus, the 2007 edition. We're going to highlight just a couple of things in there that you want to make sure your department is doing on a routine basis. And if your department doesn't have, there should be absolutely no excuse for this to say, well, geez, we don't have the funding for this, all right? If your department's spending money and you are an all-services emergency service organization, you want to be absolutely bulletproof to make sure your department all day, every day, is doing these four things that Mike and I are going to talk about. The first one is in Section 16.2 of the 1911 standard, and it is the annual weighing of apparatus. And we're just going to quote here right out of the standard for a moment. The fully loaded fire apparatus shall be weighed following the procedure specified in Section 16.2 through 16.2.5 to ensure that the weight of the front and the rear axles and the gross vehicle weight do not exceed the gross vehicle weight ratings and the gross vehicle weight rating or gross combination weight rating as shown on the rating plate on the apparatus. That is in the 1911 standard. It's also referenced in the 1901 standard. And, Mike, I know that you've had some upfront and personal experience with having departments that you've worked with or analyzed to have them weigh their units, and any comments that you'd like to have on that. You only need to have a driver and a location either in your first due area or some adjacent area that has scale capabilities that you can pull the front axle of the unit up on, get a weight, the entire unit up on the scale, get a weight, and then the back axle and get a weight. And if you have a sand and gravel quarry, a cement batch mixing plant, an asphalt plant, it generally might mean you might even have to call your local brothers in blue down to the police department and find out where those facilities might be if you're not familiar. But there's not too many locations that Mike and I have ever seen, unless you're literally in the middle of a desert somewhere, that you don't have the capabilities to get your fire trucks weighed. So, Michael, some comments on your experience with that.
Well, Tom, as you well know, in the departments that we have visited within the last 4 years, we have only found one department with all of their apparatus that could make weight on all the axles. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand the methodology and the reasoning for weighing trucks the way that we do. Each axle has a rating. In one case, if you recall, you and I went on a consulting job, and the truck was supposed to be equipped with a 31,000-pound rear axle, and it ended up being equipped with a 27,000-pound rear axle on a single-axle tanker. So certainly we found that problem and that shortcoming. But as it relates to the axles, by you pulling the front axle on and getting a weight ticket, you can then compare that axle weight to the axle rating of the axle in your vehicle. And basically, if the number on the ticket is greater than the number of the axle weighting, then you're overweight, and so forth and so on, with the rear axle weighing that singularly and comparing that to the axle rating on a rear axle. And then, of course, if you have tandems, you're going to put the tandems up on, and you're going to weigh that and compare that to the tandem axle weighting. And then, of course, there's a plate that all our listeners can look for, and it's generally in and around the door area or the driver's area. It may be on the door itself on the end, or on the apparatus in the door well on the end, a plate that highlights the GVRW, the gross vehicle weight rating of the entire vehicle, and then each of the axle weights. And you're going to compare all those numbers, and then obviously if the numbers that you get off of the scale are greater than those numbers listed, then you have an issue. But more importantly to that, the issue may manifest itself early on just by things like worn brakes. If your apparatus is going through brakes every 5 or 6 months, a pretty good bet would be that the apparatus is overweight and it's a symptom of a much more serious problem, certainly. And we go back years ago when a fire truck ran into a tree after losing its brakes in Waterbury, Connecticut, where two brother firefighters were killed. And then the state of Connecticut embarked on a program to inspect a fire apparatus voluntarily. And they did a number of small cities, towns, and villages and found out in a six-month period that 35% of the trucks that they weighed had such terrible, or 35% of the trucks that they inspected were so deficient that they couldn't leave the inspectional area. And a number of those issues, severe issues, were around brakes, suspension, springs, steering boxes, and a like that were defective. And then it goes right back to how much did the truck weigh, and most of those trucks were overweight and created that condition.
you know, Mike, so we go through, first thing, it's like our own personal health. You know, most of us, as we get older in life, we tend not to shed the pounds. It's getting gets increasingly difficult even to maintain your weight. That exact same thing happens to fire apparatus. We tend to buy more stuff, put it on there, and even if the unit were proverbially street legal in the beginning, it's not uncommon to find it that units that are older, that they become overweight, or if the unit was designed initially and minimally axled for the application, that you're overweight, and that now you need to take care of that. Second thing in the 1911 standard is section 18.2, the annual service testing of pumper apparatus. If you have a local drafting site, a pumper, a test pit, as some larger departments might have, or any location where you can safely take the unit and draft with it, the standard in Chapter 18 does an excellent job of outlining the requirements to do a pumper certification test. And in the appendix of the 1911 standard, there is material that has sample forms in Annex C to take you through a daily and quarterly inspection of the unit, in addition to the a form that can be used by any department to record the pumper performance testing for that. It's, again, it's making sure that our equipment that we are literally, our lives are depending upon to perform properly, are working up to their peak performance to ensure that the apparatus is going to work when we need it. Which then brings us to, we went from pumpers, now in section 19.1.1, the annual testing of aerial equipment. Now here, it's the standard is requiring that an aerial device be non-destructively tested at least once every 5 years, all right, at times after me. I take that back. I stand corrected. The standard, all inspections and tests specified in the standard, except those specifically designated as non-destructive tests, all right, shall be conducted at least annually after major repairs or overhaul, following the use of an aerial device when the device has been subjected to unusual operating conditions, stress, or load. That could go to exactly what Mike was talking about with the one department in Connecticut where their tower ladder, rested down against the building because the inboard outrigger was improperly supported. Or the fourth one is when there's reason to believe that the usage has exceeded the manufacturer's recommended aerial device operating procedures. The non-destructive testing portion is to be done at a minimum at least every 5 years. And the suggestion here is, from a budgetary standpoint, while that test does cost some money, and typically you can be looking at inspection costs in the area of approximately $800 to $1,000 to have an independent testing company come in. They give you a written report, which is like getting your annual physical in a what would hopefully be a clean bill of health, but as in most cases with aerial devices, you're getting a list of repairs that maybe you were not aware of that needed to be done. Then you need to have enough money in your apparatus budget to be able to initiate those repairs the same way you would as if you had done a pumper service test and found out that it maybe failed the 250 PSI, the 50% test, and now you need to do a little bit more investigation to find out what's wrong with the fire pump, where I think, Mike, some departments make the mistake is that they buy expensive, what they would consider to be expensive apparatus, being engines or trucks, and in some cases, particularly now, because with the way our economy is and budget constraints, and the fact that if you're in a department where a good portion of your budget is already going out for salaries and benefits and other mandated things that the department is charged for, that they look to the maintenance budget and say, well, let's cut some money out of that. Well, you cut money out of the maintenance budget, what's the impact going to be? You're going to have vehicles that are going to go not repaired until you get the money, or you've identified significant issues that need to be fixed on the apparatus, but the unit's now going to be deadlined. You better hope that you have a pretty robust reserve fleet to be able to compensate for that. So Mike, your experience on aerial testing and pumper testing. Any comments on that?
Yeah, Tom. Like you said, there are three very important times, and I think we tend to miss them. The first is when the vehicle's actually delivered new. It goes back years ago to a story about a pumper in upstate New York, and my friend who works for the Office of Fire Prevention and Control was begging this adjoining fire district to do an acceptance test on their pumper before they put it in service, and the fire chief and others from that department exclaimed that it came with a UL certificate and it had already been tested, and this was redundancy at its worst and a waste of time. And my friend said, well, just humor us and please do the test. It ended up that they did the NFPA acceptance test as it's written, and a 1250 pumper struggled to pump 755 gallons per minute new. The truck was sent back to the manufacturer. It stayed there for 30 days. It came back. They went and did another acceptance test. And again, the truck failing to pump over 755 gallons per minute. And the fire department told the manufacturer that you got 30 days and don't bring it back again unless it can pump what it says it's supposed to pump, at least 1,250 gallons per minute. It ends up that there were metal filings in the automatic transmission chamber, and when the manufacturer hooked up this commercial chassis automatic transmission to the fire pump, they hooked it up to pump in fourth gear and not fifth. And so those two were key factors in the truck's inability to pump its rated capacity. Once those issues were addressed and fixed, this 1250 pumper pumped 1450 in the new acceptance test as it should be. And so, you know, you can have all the certificates you want, but you really need to make the truck perform in your jurisdiction. Had they not listened to the advice of my friend, they would have paid an awful lot of money for a 1250 pumper that in reality was only a 755 gallon per minute pumper. And then, of course, once a year goes by, the truck comes out of warranty, and any issue like that, you would have a hard time trying to convince anybody to fix it for free because now you own the problem. And so it's in everybody's best interest to do that testing when it's new. The other issue with aerials is please. I think I can speak for most of the fire chiefs out there when we tell you this. If you are operating the truck and you whack the side of a building or a cornice, or you hit with the tip of an aerial, you may hit hard into a parapet, you may ding something or bend something, please fess up and tell us. Much better, I think, to find out like that than to have you take the apparatus and do some damage and not fess up, and then the next fire you go out to, you put the apparatus under load and we have some kind of catastrophic failure. It's really, really important that if you do any kind of perceived damage at all, and accidents happen. Stuff happens regardless of how well we're trained. It's an adrenaline rush. It's time. It's excitement. And, you know, you pull a wrong lever here or you push the wrong knob there, and all of a sudden you get yourself into a little bit of trouble. But it's really, really important for all our listeners that if you have some kind of incident like that, please don't bed the aerial device and take it back to the station like nothing happened, because something did happen. And again, it could be the symptom of what could manifest itself and to be a much more serious problem. And you could actually, if the vehicle were to have a catastrophic collapse, you could actually hurt or kill one of our own people.
Very, very good point, Mike. All right. That's going to now take us to the another section in the 1911 standard, section 19.10.11. It's on page 53 for those people who are following or want to look at something. It's the water system inspection and test with respect to an aerial device that has a waterway. We all know during the course of the last several years, there's been numerous waterway incidents on aerial devices that, whether previously they were left unreported or, they just happened. And as Mike said, somebody just like buried it and nobody knew what was going on. There was the very tragic line of duty death fatality in the volunteer department outside of Erie, Pennsylvania, where the assistant chief was killed when the monitor launched off the waterway. These are the types of things that we want to be avoiding, and it's just a matter of a visual inspection of the unit. That section of the standard takes you through that, together with, again, as we mentioned earlier, in Annex C of that standard. If your department is one that just doesn't have good record keeping, doesn't have adequate forms, there's at least a suggested form that can be used for a daily and weekly visual and walk-around and operational inspections of the apparatus, as well as quarterly inspections and suggested forms that you could use to record the pump test and the aerial test data. So we're talking now about using baseline technology with respect to making sure that our apparatus is properly taken care of. And the last thing we'll cover before we take a quick break is the 1932 standard on the inspection, maintenance, and testing of ground ladders. That should be done on an annual basis. There is some of that test equipment that probably is beyond the capabilities of most fire departments with respect to the non-destructive testing and the weight testing, so that would require your department to contract that with an outside independent testing agency, whereas if you get into the hose testing aspects of the standard, the 1962 standard, that is something that can be done using department resources at absolutely no cost. If your department is such that you have the funding stream to do that, there are a number of independent, certified testing companies that can come in and test your hose for you without you using your apparatus. Again, there's a very good article in the current issue of Firehouse Magazine entitled Overcoming Barriers to Testing Fire Hose. And that's one thing, Mike, it blows my mind that people might have otherwise an excellent, pretty creditable maintenance program, but you ask them, who tests your hose, and they'll generally look at you and say, well, we do. And, well, when was the last time you did that? And you get somebody that looks around, and particularly in a volunteer organization, they'll say, I think Jimmy was chief when we did that last. Well, when was Jimmy chief? I think he went out in 2007. Well, it's 2009, sports fans. If you can't take the time and investment in your own personal safety using limited technology, arguably, to test the hose to make sure that it's going to perform the way we expect it to under very adverse conditions, then I'd say if you're unwilling to do that, you're probably the kind of person that goes around and drives your vehicle for the rated life expectancy and you never check the oil level on your dipstick or never change the oil, period, because you just figure, well, it came with oil, so I'm hoping that for the life of the vehicle there's going to be oil in the crankcase and it's going to properly lubricate the engine. Those two things, ground ladders and fire hose, what we virtually rely upon, we're risking our lives to go put out and extinguish a fire that might be property-related if we've already done a primary and secondary search and there's no life safety hazard. Who's at risk inside that structure? That's us. And each year we tragically have near-miss incidents with ground ladders that fail, with burst hose lengths. Even that can happen even if you have the hose tested. So we need to make sure that the equipment that we bring to the game is safety rated just as well as we are. You can be the most physically fit firefighter in the world and could be the three-time combat challenge champion, but if you show up with equipment that hasn't been tested, hasn't been maintained, with ground ladders that haven't been looked at, lubricated, cleaned, and tested, and hose that hasn't been tested ever, I suspect that you are just as much at risk as the guy that shows up that is the proverbial, you know, 350-pound firefighter with the 56-inch waist and the three different scanners, five pagers, and keys to every fire station within a 30-mile radius. You're not any better off than that guy if you can't certify and test and inspect the equipment that your very life depends on.
Hey, so, Tom, I got some news for you. I have a couple comments on hose.
Hey, okay, well, what do you got, Mike?
You're going to find this hard to believe, but I do know a little something. Well, one is going back to the testing of hose. Again, it's something very important that you need to do when the hose is delivered and new. A department not too far from me got 1,500 feet of 5-inch hose, brand new. They promptly put it on their truck without testing that hose. And then the first fire that they went to, the hose looked like a yard sprinkler system. There was a defect in the hose that manifested itself once water was put in the hose under pressure, under pump pressure, and it looked like a garden sprinkler. And then another point to be made here, there are a number, particularly for the volunteer sector, where it's so hard to get people and retain them, and you don't want to really necessarily beat them up testing hose. And so there are a number of private contractors out there that tend to do a really good job, and they will come in for a fee during the day, during the week, and they will actually come in and test the hose for you. Obviously, it's not for everybody because there is a cost factor associated, but beats having to go out back and fling a few more chickens at the chicken barbecue or pancakes, you know, and do fundraising. And with things, with time at such a premium, to have these guys come in during the day and during the week and do this kind of arduous task, it just makes a lot of sense if you can afford it.
Right. Thanks, Mike. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects. This month, we're talking about safety in and around the apparatus and equipment we use. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. This month we're talking about personal involvement, health and safety in and about operating on our fire apparatus. But before we go back and launch into our subject matter, we always want to go back and, I guess as they would say on Click and Clack, a shameless plug for Mike and Tom for some of the things that we are going to be doing during the week of July 20th down in Baltimore, Maryland at the Firehouse Expo. Brother Mike's going to be doing 2 days of an all-day program together with Rich Bowers, the chief of Montgomery County Fire and Rescue Services, Jeff Williamson, captain, and training chief Mike Clemens, talking about driver training with your eyes, head, hands, and feet. And that's going to be offered on both Tuesday and Wednesday as a part of the hands-on program. Mike and I are going to be putting on a presentation talking about the status of the fire apparatus industry in 2009, and we'll be doing that on Friday morning at 10:15. And for those early risers, we'd like to see as many as possible. We're going to be doing a live Apparatus Architects podcast on Friday morning at 8:30, and that'll be in room 313 in the convention center. So,
boy, that's always a good time, huh, Tom?
Yep, 8:30, Mike, that's like the middle of the morning for you, for me, and that's like the crack of dawn for you. So that ought to be pretty exciting. But there are some other programs going on, you know, that morning commencing at 08:30. So there's going to be a number of things going on, and including some very, very good speakers. In fact, our own good friend Billy Goldfeder is going to be we're up against him there. Billy's going to be doing a three-hour class that morning talking about kind of like what we're talking about, firefighter injury and deaths in 2009. Why isn't it working? So we know Chief Goldfeder won't be in the class, but we'd like to invite any of our other listeners to come down and participate in the class. We'll do a live Q&A session with whatever happens to come up, and we'll see what develops. So again, there's just going to be numerous excellent training opportunities during that week of July, starting on classes start on Tuesday, the 21st of July, and both Brother Mike and I will be there for the duration, as they say, and we'll be happy to meet and greet any of the listeners and help you out with any particular issues that you might have relating to apparatus or apparatus safety and design aspects for things that we've talked about in the past. So we're going to finish up this month's segment talking about a NIOSH report that was issued on firefighter fatalities from vehicle crashes. And a couple of things that I guess would be the type of thing to say, you know, I kind of remember reading that in the headline, and when you kind of ponder that for a little bit, it really causes you, or at least it causes Mike and I, to sit back and take pause. And one of the first things that came out of that analysis was that more than one-third of the total vehicle fatalities that were involved firefighters between 1997 and 2006 occurred while those people were operating with their personal vehicles. So, Mike, you are much more of a subject expert in this area than I. Comments on that particular finding? Well, I guess maybe not surprising to many of our listeners, it's, boy, the kind of thing that really kind of makes you wake up and take pause here. More than a third of the fatalities in vehicles in that period, 97 to 2006, that didn't occur when we were on the apparatus. It occurred when we were operating in our POVs.
You know, truly a sad, sad statistic, Brother Tom, that we've had so many wrecks in POVs. And, again, there are a number of factors. The first thing is that in many states, courtesy lights are given out to those firefighters so that they can respond from their homes to the fire station to man apparatus. And many states, those courtesy lights are just simply that. It's asking for permission to give way. And those lights and the permission to use those lights are given out, and in most cases with, like, no training whatsoever. And although the cars are not being operated as emergency vehicles, although in some states they are, they're given permission over and above just a normal courtesy light to be operated like emergency vehicles, regardless of what the state, we have young people that have this adrenaline rush that are basically driving too fast in their own personal cars, trying to go help. They have all the best intentions, but yet it ends up in a really tremendous tragedy, not only for the family of the victim, but for the entire fire department. And just looking back to the first of this year, once again, there have been any number of firefighters that have been hurt or killed in incidents surrounding POVs. I think the biggest causative factor is that there's just a complete lack of training and appreciation for what goes on in the mind of a teenager or a 20-something that all of a sudden we give them permission to join the emergency service. And with that comes heaps of responsibility. And to pour on that responsibility and not have any training, again, has just resulted in, I think, a failure for everybody and a lot of line-of-duty deaths.
You know, Mike, and again, I think that the saddest part to me is when you look at and read some of the, as they say, you know, the details behind the story. These people, as you mentioned, they're typically in their early, you know, late teens or early 20s, were well intended, you know, probably excited, you know, beyond any kind of assumption that they're, you know, have joined the emergency services and participating to help their community. And the situations that get involved here are just beyond tragic. And it doesn't seem there to be getting any better. So to me, it's a matter of getting the message out to these departments as they get and obtain this new raw talent, rookie talent into the department, that we need to spend some time going over what the rules of the road are, what the expectations are with respect to response to the station in your personal own vehicle, and to make that as a heightened awareness. No one likes to be singled out under any condition for doing something foolish or stupid. But here, the foolishness or the lack of paying attention is to the heightened amount of hazards that are out on the public highways. It gets to the point where now it turns into a tragedy. The second one we talked upon briefly, but we'll talk about how now technology and rules and regulations have now come to impact us on this, and then I'll let that segue into Mike's comments. In a 2006 survey indicated that more than 75% of firefighters killed in motor vehicle accidents were not wearing their seatbelts. It went back to what we talked about early on with respect to technology and technology interface with the fire service, and the fact that, from my humble estimation, I wouldn't necessarily rank seatbelts as a technology item, but now we are going to have technology forced upon us, because starting with vehicles purchased after January 1st of 2009, the new NFPA 1901 standard is going to require, in addition to other safety-related issues, a seatbelt monitoring system so that it will indicate in the cab, both visually and with an audible signal, that if some brother or sister firefighter is in the seat and the seatbelt is not buckled, you're going to now be so warned. I know we have had spoken with many people in our circles, that was people at the instructional level, at training officers. I've then had captains in fire departments tell me, we're just too busy and we make too many runs and I can't be bothered to put on my seatbelt. We're talking now going right back to initiative number one in terms of the cultural change, a sense of personal accountability and responsibility for your own safety, health, and welfare. And I guess, Mike, my last thing will be, it's pretty damn obvious to me that based on a hard number statistic that you can't fight, and the fact that now it has been regulated, tells me that once again, we in the fire service have been unable to regulate our own behavioral attitudes, and now it's going to be regulated for us because we hadn't figured out how to do it with our own resources.
Well, that's absolutely correct, Tom, and about ready to publish a series of articles on rules and CDLs in Firehouse Magazine. They're going to start to run in July. One of the issues is that in many states, firefighters are actually exempt from wearing seatbelts as it relates to legally. Other states, they are not. As of just the last month or two, there were firefighters that were actually arrested and charged in accidents, and one of those charges leveled against them was the failure to wear a seatbelt. So there are some states that are much more in tune than others. Completely exempt firefighters from that. Yet the NFPA is clear. It's in the standard that before an apparatus operator can move any vehicle, to put the vehicle in any gear at all, that it's the operator, it's not the chief, it's not the officer, but it's the operator of that vehicle that must make sure that everybody is completely dressed, seated, and belted in an enclosed position. And we have spoke about on this show a number of times about at times how difficult seatbelts are to put on. As many know, we are working on that. We didn't get the problem yesterday. This problem has kind of accrued itself over time, and so it's going to take some time to figure out a solution to the problem. But we have any number of really smart people that are working to that end to make seatbelts more user-friendly. Moreover, as you related to technology, there are some apparatus manufacturers that have the wherewithal to put in the cabs not only updated seatbelts, but they have airbags, frontal bags, and the basis of those safety systems working correctly is born in the fact that you have a seatbelt on. Just like in your own personal automobile, the safety devices, those airbags, are of limited use if you don't have your seatbelt on. It's all one complete safety system, and take one of those elements away, and it really cuts down the viability of the system totally, and that's how we end up getting in trouble. On the positive note, I think everybody can see just from the wrecks that have occurred in the last year or so that there has been what I would consider a significant increase in seatbelt use. You see any number of wrecks now where firefighters are walking away basically based on the fact that they have seatbelts on. So I think we are making a tremendous difference. You and I and people like Chief Goldfeder, certainly Dr. Burke Clark with his seatbelt pledge has played a big role in getting people to buckle up. And again, it's just something that you can't numerically qualify or quantify, but I think things are, just from a national perspective, I think we are getting more people to wear their belts, and it is making a difference. So there is a positive side, but for those of you that still fight it, I mean, I work in the New York City Fire Department in a ladder company, and I try to put my seatbelt on. I can't say that I'm 100%, but 99% of the time going out on runs, I have my seatbelt on. And we're doing 2,800 to 4,400 runs a year, depending on what company I work in. And if we can do it, then certainly most everybody else can do it.
Mike, I just want to go back to one thing here. We've been a rather somber presentation up to this point, but you mentioned 2,800 to 4,400 runs, depending on what company you're in. The company that's running 4,400 runs a year, which company might that be?
That is the engine company, Brother Tom. They go out and serving the citizens of the city of New York, doing EMS as well as firefighting runs.
Oh, so the engine is going out the door more than the truck then. I just want to get that out there for our listeners.
That's correct. The truck only leaves when they need real firefighters, Brother Tom.
Okay. And for those listeners that would like to see that point debated, we once again would encourage you to show up at 08:30 while Brother Mike will have to be there with his 55-gallon drum of Starbucks. It will be worth watching and listening to. All right, we're going to finish up, Mike, and this just kind of, to me, puts the ribbon on the ribbon and the bow on the present, although what we've been talking about this month has been, to me, pretty sobering. The Firefighter Fatality Investigation and Prevention Program report also identified, and I quote, "The number of deaths caused by motor vehicle crashes has not decreased and suggests that the number of deaths could be reduced by enforcing the use of seat belts at all times when the vehicle is in motion and by providing additional driver/operator training, appropriate safety equipment and compliance monitoring. So, again, that much like initiative number one, that's a lot of words and a mouthful. We've talked about the enforcing of seatbelts. Mike has been one of the principal folks leading the charge to improve and increase the quantity, but more importantly, the quality of driver-operator training. We've talked about the testing of our equipment, the appropriate use of safety equipment. And the last thing, let's talk about compliance monitoring. And here we're not talking about the little black box that's going to tell the chief, you know, if we blew through the intersection and we're doing 45 miles an hour when previously we would have swore, chief, I stopped, and it was like a rolling stop. I'm not saying we didn't come to a complete stop, but, chief, I know we weren't doing more than 15, 16 miles an hour through the intersection. They dump the data out of the little black box and find out that Shan blew the intersection at 47 miles an hour, didn't even tap the brakes. Not going to be able to get away with that. We're talking about compliance monitoring, Mike. In my mind, this is standing up for our own accountability, but having compliance within the three, four, five, six people, however many people are sitting in that apparatus. It is the item that we're operating in as a team, and we're looking out for one another. That if you're my officer, you're not going to let me get away with some unsafe act because, well, I don't want to make an issue over this because I'm Tom's friend. Compliance monitoring means that you're the boss. If you've got the horns or the axes on your helmet, whether you're a sergeant, lieutenant, captain, chief officer going up the line, you expect those troops to follow the safety SOGs and the requirements of your organization, as they say, all day, every day. Nobody gets a free pass because you're a friend of the chief, because you're the chief's brother-in-law. It means that we take our responsibilities from a safety perspective serious enough that we're going to counsel and, where necessary, have to imply punitive actions with folks that do not follow the safety guidelines or the policies that our organization has out there. So, Mike, your thoughts on that? You're probably a better one to speak to this because you're in the front seat and you're responsible for your safety and the safety of the other five brothers on that apparatus. So, compliance monitoring, we're talking about taking this new attitude and making it work for us and just not relying upon electronics and technology to do this for us.
Yeah, I think there's just really a clear choice here, and the choices are very simple. If you as an officer, and I think this cultural change has to start at the top. It becomes very difficult for company officers to enforce policies when chief officers show up at fires without seatbelts, and then the deputy chief shows up without seatbelts, and then the assistant chief shows up without seatbelts. And it just is telling of the whole organization that obviously the seatbelt rule isn't one that we're really going to enforce versus maybe some other rules within the organization. So compliance has to start from the top. But moreover, there's a choice to be made here. And just from a personal level, and even as a chief, you have two choices to make. You can enforce a policy like the seatbelt policy that in the beginning may be quite unpopular, or you can bury your head in the sand and ignore that. And then when, God forbid, the apparatus does get into a wreck and one of your people gets ejected and killed, then it's going to be your responsibility to go knock at that door and explain to the widow or the mom and the dad why that firefighter isn't going to come home because they did not have a seatbelt on and they were ejected out of the vehicle. So I think that's really a stark choice to make. Do you want to have somebody that's unhappy with you for 30 days, or do you want to have them dead and deal with all that? So I think it's just a real simple choice. And having been on a team that had to go make that knock at the door and inform somebody that their husband and their father wasn't coming home as we approach Father's Day here. Probably one of the toughest things that I certainly had to do in my career is to go to one of our good friends' doors and knock on the door and tell his wife and kids that he wasn't coming home. And although it wasn't a driving-related incident, the pain of having to make that long walk up to the sidewalk and up to the front door and then having to go through that is something that, quite frankly, I don't wish on anybody. And so rather than having to do that, then you have to muster up some courage as an officer and say, hey, if you don't wear a seatbelt, there's rules here, and you will be suspended for 30 days or something will happen. And then for you to muster the courage as an officer to make that choice and say, okay, you didn't follow the rules, and we're going to have to follow through here. It's nothing personal. The reality is I like you a lot. I like you so much that I want to see you continue to live, and I don't want to go to your funeral, and I don't want to be part of it. So we need you to go home for a few days and think about this policy, think about safety, think about the seriousness of it, and then you can come back and join us. And I think that's really how it needs to go. Do you have any thoughts about this, Tom, or any final thoughts?
Yeah, Mike, just final thoughts to wrap up here. This being the month that we in the fire service for the past several years have traditionally reevaluated and stepped back, whether it was taking a safety stand down or reviewing different things that we do and analyzing our safety and equipment. To me, it's heartening, as Mike said. Yes, we don't mean to paint this big, black, dark picture like Mike mentioned about his incident in the city and my observations over this very finely run, you know, all-volunteer department up in Monroe County this past week that, yeah, there are some bright rays of light out there, that it's not this doom and gloom that everybody's doing stuff stupid. But when you reflect back on either individual incidents or, to me, Mike, and looking at the NIOSH report, and it's almost, to me, it's beyond sobering. It's just looking at, we're 5 years plus into these safety initiatives that the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation that, you know, developed, and looking at, are we making headway? Yes. I would suspect, though, to say that as I get older and tend to get a little more crotchety and probably less impatient, or more impatient, rather, is that you'd like to see the progress coming along a little more lively, to have more success stories out there. Yeah, we're going to, given the increasing number of runs and incidents and the types of incidents we respond to, Mike and I are sharp enough at least to know that, you know, we're never going to reduce, we're never going to completely eliminate accidents or line-of-duty deaths. What we'd like to see is a gradual reduction, and the fact of the message getting out there, and particularly in light of some of the significant incidents that have happened, things that we've talked about in previous podcasts with the apparatus-on-apparatus accidents, or intersection accidents that, you know, to me it's tragic, but it's just the way the emergency services operate. We have to almost have these incidents. We hope that we learn from them to the point where they become less repetitive, and hopefully to the point where they just don't happen at all. Technology is a great thing. The NFPA standards are there that are Bibles and rules to live by. I would suspect that if we had organizations that had more internal accountability, where people that were just intuitively responsible for their own personal health, safety, and welfare, and it was driven home at a higher organization level, I would think that you would find out, if you were able to break those people apart and analyze them, we'd hopefully find out that statistics would be running more in our favor and running in our favor rather than running against us. So, Mike, that's my final thoughts. Again, we'd like to thank our listeners for tuning into this segment of the Apparatus Architects. And once again, look forward to seeing folks during the week of July 20th down in the great city of Baltimore, where both Michael and Tom We'll be putting on programs, several programs we'll be doing together, as well as some things that we'll be doing individually during the course of the week. For anyone that has questions or something they'd like us to field on the air, please send those questions in to podcast@firehouse.com. And until the next time, for Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur, please, everybody, respond safely, stay well, and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.